From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
As a result of the Astor Place riot and about 22 people being killed by the militia in front of the Astor Place Theater, theater managers became less and less willing to present entertainments that would appeal to this broad social audience.
Welcome to Soundings, Popular Entertainment in 19th Century America. That's the topic this week on Soundings. My guest is a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center, Robert Allen of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. According to Robert Allen, the historical development of American popular entertainment stems from theatrical forms, including vaudeville, burlesque, dime museum performances, and circuses. But these forms underwent a fragmentation of audience following the Civil War that reflected social classes as well as notions of art, taste, and decorum. In this fragmentation, vaudeville became a cultural model of popular entertainment that influenced such 20th century forms as film, radio, and television. Bobby Allen, you come to the Humanities Center to write a book about popular entertainment in the 19th century. Let me give you a very specific jumping-off point. Tell me about going to the theater. I understand that in your view, there's a big difference between what it was like in the first part of the 19th century in contrast to what, after the Civil War and into the 20th century.
Well, certainly our experience of going to the theater, and I mean theater in the broadest sense of the term, including opera, ballet, in addition to legitimate theater today, is quite different from what that experience would have been for someone in the early part of the 19th century. If you had gone to the theater in Charleston, South Carolina, which had a very famous theater, the Dock Street Theater, in the early part of the 19th century, if you had gone there in, let's say, 1830, you would have arrived at the theater at 7 o'clock in the evening, and you would have expected to have stayed for 3 hours or so. You would have seen a main dramatic piece performed, but it probably would have been preceded by something quite different. You might have gone to see Richard III, for example, but that would have been preceded by a farce.
What, a warm-up act of some sort?
Yes. Or it would have been succeeded by an afterpiece, which just as likely could have been a farce, a burlesque, a parody of a famous play, perhaps even a parody of a Shakespearean play. You would have attended this in a theater that was designed to accommodate people of all social classes, so that if you had been a landowner in Charleston, a wealthy landowner, you would have taken your place with your peers in the boxes that ringed the theater, usually two or three or four tiers of boxes arranged along the sides and the back of the theater. Down in front, in what we now call the orchestra, but what in the 19th century was called the pit, would have been the middlings, they were called, people of roughly middle-class social orientation. And then up in the gallery, up in the cheap seats, would have been stevedores and manual workers, and
this is what Shakespeare would have called the groundlings. Only
the groundlings would have been in the pits, but these are the gallery gods they came to be called in the 19th century. And in the case of Charleston, perhaps even your household slaves would have taken their place in the gallery with others who were much poorer than you would have been or than the people sitting in the pit.
Bobby Allen, we're talking about your forthcoming study here of popular entertainment in the 19th century. What kind of social function did popular entertainment have? Again, you know, we think of television today as very pervasive. The TV networks try to reach many demographic targets. Did that same sort of thing occur in 19th century popular entertainment?
To get back to this description of what going to the theater must have been like in a place like Charleston in 1830, one of the social functions of going to the theater was to be seen at the theater. And in fact, there's a marvelous piece of commentary from a New York newspaper in the 1830s criticizing the light levels at the Bowery Theater in New York.
Because you couldn't see everybody.
You couldn't be seen, exactly. And even when it became technically possible to lower the lights in the auditorium and keep the lights on the stage up, when gas lighting came in the 1820s and 30s, theaters resisted plunging of the auditorium into darkness for the reason that people, particularly those in the boxes, came to the theater to be seen and not necessarily to see what was going on the stage. You would probably have not been able to hear more than about 30% of the lines spoken from the stage anyhow, because there was so much noise going on in the theater.
Did people eat and talk and move back and forth? Was it, characterize all of that for me.
It's really difficult to get a handle on what that must have been like. From the accounts that we have, at times, it was more like going to a street carnival than it was going to a theater, as we in the 20th century would know that experience. People in the gallery brought their dinners and threw apple cores and beer bottles simply over the side of the gallery railing onto the heads of the poor people down in the pit. The people in the pits, in some theaters, the pits had no seats at all. People stood during the performance, or where they did have seats, they were simply benches that were unattached, and people moved the benches around to suit their comfort.
This is like the infield at the Indianapolis 500.
Yes, very much more like that, or like a performance of Rocky Horror Picture Show or something in the midnight movies, where there's as much going on in the audience as there is on the stage or on the screen. Prostitutes freely plied their trade in the upper tiers of the gallery. In fact, written into some municipal theater licensing ordinances, there were clauses that governed the degree to which prostitutes could ply their trade and where they could do this in the theater. There were separate entrances and exits for people going up into the gallery so that the working class people and the prostitutes wouldn't cross the paths of the more wealthy and socially prominent members of the audience. The audience for Antebellum Theater was predominantly male. Women did attend. A respectable woman would never have attended a 19th century theater performance unaccompanied by a male patron.
This had nothing to do necessarily with the nature of the entertainment. This was just part of the larger social notions of
sociability.
Correct.
Yes, that's correct. If you were an unaccompanied female in a theater, you were presumed to be a prostitute.
Goodness.
And chances are you were a prostitute. Mm-hmm. So the theater experience was a male-governed experience. Women did attend, and they did sit in the boxes, and they did go to the theater to be observed as well as to see what was going on. But it was a mixing of social classes. It was a heterogeneous performance tradition. Opera, ballet, farce, tragedy, all thrown together in the same night's entertainment, performed for a very heterogeneous audience. Now, it was not an egalitarian institution.
Sure, you've implied that.
The boxes were clearly set aside for the socially prominent and economically prominent. The gallery was clearly set aside for working class people and for prostitutes, and the pit was everyone that fell sort of in between. That is what characterizes Antebellum Theater, at least through the first part of the 1840s.
And then what occurs? Is there some sort of a sea change there?
There's very much a change there. And one of the things I'm interested in doing in this study is documenting that change and then following out its consequences into the latter half of the 19th century.
Well, now here's where this word fragmentation, I've read the prospectus for your book here, and I take it that this is where fragmentation becomes an important consideration for you.
What seems to have happened is that this model of Antebellum Theater, which again was a heterogeneous performance tradition performed for a heterogeneous audience, began to fall apart around mid-century.
Have you nailed this down? I mean,
it's not just me. Other theater historians have noted this this change. David Grimstead, in a very nice book called Melodrama Unveiled, which was published in the mid-60s, ends his book with an account of a rather famous theater riot that is taken by theater historians as being the indicative of the fragmentation of the American theater audience and a corresponding fragmentation of the performance tradition. The riot is fascinating in and of itself.
Where did this occur?
New York City, mm-hmm. May 1849. The Astor Place Theater, which had been built some years before by wealthy New Yorkers as a place where serious English drama could be performed to a wealthy audience.
The PBS of 1849.
Yes. The Astor Place Theater management had invited an English actor named William Charles Macready to perform. Macready was a leading English Shakespearean actor.
Right.
And the Bowery Theater, which was a few blocks further downtown, very much a popular theater, presenting melodrama and minstrel shows and whatever, in addition to Shakespeare, invited an American actor named Edwin Forrest to appear at the same time. Macready and Forrest had a running feud for several years, really over how Shakespeare should be performed. Macready made the mistake of saying some rather unfortunate things about Forrest and about Americans. And when he gave his initial performance at the Astor Place Theater in May 1849, Forrest's people were there waiting for Macready, and they refused to allow him to take the stage.
And this led to a riot.
They booed him off the stage.
Goodness.
The militia was called out, and the next evening when Macready attempted to take the stage, some of Forrest's supporters were arrested and put in the basement of the theater.
Well, this is a colorful anecdote, but how does this tie back into this notion of a fragmentation of popular entertainment in the 19th century?
As a result of the Astor Place riot and about 22 people being killed by the militia in front of the Astor Place Theater,
goodness,
theater managers became less and less willing to present entertainments that would appeal to this broad social audience. The component parts of the entertainment tradition that an antebellum theater audience would have been familiar with, burlesque, opera, ballet,
melodrama,
variety acts, melodrama, spectacle theater, began to separate out and become autonomous entertainment forms in the latter half of the 19th century, appealing to different, in some cases overlapping, but different audiences. Burlesque, for example, which in the early part of the 19th century had simply meant a comic parody of a play, came to take on the sexual titillation connotations that it carried with it until it finally died in the 1930s and 1940s.
Only to be reborn again on the Playboy Channel.
Not only on the Playboy Channel, but in Sugar Babies, the revival of burlesque that Mickey Rooney and Ann Miller did a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Written appropriately enough by Ralph Allen, who is a theater historian and a great collector of burlesque sketches and anecdotes.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about 19th century American popular entertainment. My guest is Robert Allen of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. During his fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Robert Allen is tracing the development of American popular entertainment. According to Robert Allen, 19th century theatrical forms, such as vaudeville, burlesque, and circuses, underwent a fragmentation of audience following the Civil War that reflected social classes as well as notions of art, taste, and decorum. Here is Robert Allen.
As these particular entertainment forms began to appeal to particular social groups, there resulted this fragmentation of the American popular entertainment market that I've alluded to. And it seems to characterize American popular entertainment in the latter half of the 19th century. Now, what happens at the end of that period, in the 1880s and 1890s, is you have very shrewd theatrical entrepreneurs who attempt to reconsolidate a more broadly based audience around newer forms of popular entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And the model there is vaudeville. Vaudeville arose in the 1880s and 1890s on the basis of variety acts, jugglers, acrobats, song and dance teams, ethnic comedians, that had always been a part of the larger theatrical fabric in 19th century, antebellum 19th century America. But these types of acts got separated out, performed in beer gardens, concert saloons in the middle to latter part of the 19th century. And theatrical entrepreneurs like B.F. Keith, Edward Albee, Oscar Hammerstein, Martin Beck, Alexander Pantages on the West Coast, fashioned an entertainment form around these variety acts that would appeal to a more broadly based audience. They did this in a couple of ways. First of all, by separating the sale of liquor from the performance of variety. Variety acts had been performed in concert saloons in the, from the 1860s on into the 1880s as a way of keeping patrons in a drinking mood for as long as possible. The primary way that these concert saloons made their money was by selling liquor to guests.
The concession stand.
Exactly. The variety acts were sort of an accompaniment to drinking. Entrepreneurs like Tony Pastor, E.F. Proctor, B.F. Keith, and others took liquor out of the concert saloon, which no longer made it a saloon, and made instead an entertainment form that consisted of 8 to 12 vaudeville acts performed in elaborately decorated theaters that would have attracted middle-class patrons and, just as importantly, families.
Well, and women. And here we're adding what, an element of respectability, an element of stability that up to that point had not necessarily been part of the picture.
That's right. Keith vaudeville circuit became known as the Sunday school circuit because you couldn't say anything on the stage that you couldn't say at a Sunday school picnic.
Right.
And Keith was very jealous of preserving the image of Keith vaudeville as being absolutely wholesome. Whether in practice it always was is another matter. But clearly Keith was attempting to appeal to the emerging middle class, white collar workers, urban clerical class Americans who were coming into their own at the latter half of the 19th century.
Bobby Allen, we're talking about your study of popular entertainment in 19th century American culture. Are you respectable in the sort of American studies, the the doing of American history to write a book like this? Is this really the sort of thing that a serious scholar wants to look at? And I'm asking you a lot of questions. Who's your academic constituency? Who's the broader audience that you want to reach with a study like this?
Well, I'm illegitimate in a number of different ways, Wayne. as you know, my disciplinary orientation is in film and mass communication. And I get to the study of American 19th century popular entertainment by way of asking questions about how film was introduced into American society at the end of the period that I'm now investigating. Film became a commercial entertainment form in 1896 in the United States. And it was as a result of trying to understand the institutional and social and economic context into which films came in America that I was led to sort of back up historically and take a look at the process that led to the institutional and social and economic context that obtained in the latter part of the 19th century.
So you're still unraveling the same ball of yarn.
I am, and I suppose my next project will have to be on 18th century popular entertainment, and then I'll wind up with the Greeks or something in 50 years. I don't know, but I do think that it's not just infinite regress that's involved here. There are very important structural changes that are occurring to American society. And the emergence, really, of a popular entertainment industry that is industrial in a way that antebellum theater had not been, could not conceive to have been.
An important distinction.
Yes. That does make this 19th century period important. As to the legitimacy of doing work within American cultural history, American studies, on things like burlesque and vaudeville and minstrel shows and dime museums and living
I know
pictures.
That's perfectly all right. I was just trying to promote you.
Perfectly all right, depending on who you talk to. I think that in the last 20 years, certainly, scholars have seen that examining how it is that people have spent their leisure time mm-hmm. has become an increasingly important arena of cultural investigation.
Rather than just looking at political documents and social statistics, we are now looking at the way, as you say, leisure, feelings, all of the in a way, the more difficult elements to measure in a culture.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not just moving from one group of people sociologically, but also it's moving from highbrow forms of culture, mm-hmm. literature, art, to looking at what ordinary people mm-hmm. did with their time. What kind of books did they read?
Well, you just used the word art. Would you defend American popular entertainment in the 19th century on an artistic basis? Are you looking, some of your colleagues use a term called content analysis. Is that what you are doing? Are you looking at it to find what, the intrinsic merit of the substance of what was presented to these popular audiences?
If one were so inclined, mm-hmm. one could make the argument that these forms of popular entertainment were indeed aesthetically important mm-hmm. and significant. Ragtime music found a very receptive home in vaudeville, as did jazz.
Well, see, a lot of this stuff has been excluded from the sort of cultural canon. Are you doing that? I mean, how are you mixing the, what's the blend here from your standpoint?
I'm dealing with it by avoiding the issue. I'm not trying to make the claim that burlesque sketches or minstrel show sketches or vaudeville acts represent some sort of pinnacle of aesthetic value, and that we should invert the canon and now claim that everything that has been excluded is now the most important thing to be studied. I am more interested in the cultural phenomenon mm-hmm. of popular entertainment than I am engaging in what I think are rather pointless arguments as to whether or not a burlesque sketch done in 1871 constitutes art, yeah. and the novels of William Dean Howells don't constitute art, or vice versa.
They were simply there, and they had their intrinsic appeals to different constituencies, and you're willing to leave it at that. Bobby Allen, we're talking about your history of American popular entertainment. As you look at entertainment in America today, we have, you've written a book about soap operas. We have lots of specialized, fragmented kind of entertainment on cable TV and over-the-air broadcast television. How do you see what you're looking at coming to us in the 20th century? You're looking at the origins of popular entertainment.
It seems to me that at the beginning of the 20th century, with film, there is a continuing attempt to consolidate a national audience for a particular form of popular entertainment. The case that I would make is that vaudeville provided a very useful and important model for how that audience might be fashioned, mm-hmm. and one type of performance tradition that was suitable for attracting that very broad American audience. The movies look to narratives, to stories,
yeah.
to stars, to spectacle, as ways of attracting that big national audience. And the radio networks and television networks are also predicated upon the ability to attract a very large, broadly based audience for their programming.
Mm-hmm.
Now, within the movies and within commercial radio and television, there have always been sort of sub-audiences that have found their relationship with television or radio or films to be quite different. They have only gone to see certain movies. They've only watched certain programs on radio and television. Women, for example, with soap operas,
mm-hmm.
May not have listened to the same programming at night that their husbands or fathers or brothers did. They had a form of radio that was theirs, mm-hmm. soap opera. In a culture as varied and heterogeneous as American culture has been from the very beginnings,
mm-hmm.
to talk about any particular form of cultural expression, whether it's the novel or movies or whatever, as reflecting something about the national character,
yeah.
is, I think, skating on extremely thin historical ice.
Yeah.
How can you lump together recent Irish immigrants to the United States
mm-hmm.
with people who have been in the country for, by the mid-19th century, 100 to 150 years, people whose view of America is centers around the farm or around the ranch, with people whose vision of America has to do with closely knit working class communities in Philadelphia or Boston mm-hmm. or Baltimore. How do you combine males with females in terms of trying to assess what their relationship with the larger culture was in coming up with something that's the national character or the cultural consensus? I think you resort to a flattening of those differences mm-hmm. between people of different races, ethnic orientations, and genders to the degree that you come up with rather bland and perhaps not very useful generalizations about what Americans thought or felt at a particular time.
Well, Bobby Allen, appropriately or not, you make me think of the poet Walt Whitman contradicting himself and embracing multitudes. And also in connection with Whitman, I remember, I don't know who it was, some critic said that Whitman's poetry is like several American archetypes: chewing gum that goes on forever, skyscrapers, superhighways. And I get the same feeling that metaphor, well, you help me with this. Does it not apply to what you're doing with American popular entertainment? It is just so diverse. You have so many rich sources to look at that it isn't really necessary for you to, you're not trying to be definitive, or are you? Help me with that.
I'm not at all trying to be definitive. Mm-hmm. I don't know that, particularly when we're talking about the 19th century, that it's possible for any historian to be very definitive about anything.
Sure.
Because it is of the nature of popular entertainment that we're talking about transient phenomena that don't leave paper trails.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting that you raised Walt Whitman, because Walt Whitman was an avid theater goer.
Yeah.
And
he loved the opera.
He not only loved the opera, he loved attending the Bowery Theater and mm-hmm. watching the middlings in the pit and mm-hmm. and the gallery gods absorbed by the performance of Edwin Forrest doing Richard III.
Mm-hmm.
And Whitman, in fact, has written very eloquent descriptions of that. What must have been an amazingly intricate and complex relationship between all different kinds of people sitting in the same theatrical space,
focused, as it were, on in the persona of this one actor.
Yes.
Yeah.
Robert Allen teaches film studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, he's at work on a forthcoming study of popular entertainment in 19th century America. Robert Allen is the author of Speaking of Soap Operas, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 1985. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on American Popular Entertainment, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about another aspect of popular culture. The topic will be the light side of the Dark Ages, medieval English humor. My guests will be Morton Bloomfield of Harvard University and Stephen Spector of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a discussion about the history of American popular entertainment. Wayne's guest is Robert Allen of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. From vaudeville, burlesque, and dime museums to contemporary theater, radio, television, and film, some answers and insights about American popular culture, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.